Welcome back to Hacker Slacker. I'm Jacob Petticord.
And I'm Andre Garive.
And in today's episode, we have a ton of news, some follow-up, and for our main topic, we're going to talk about some future unicorn companies. So, Andre, how are you feeling? Are you settled in?
Yep. Getting over a cold. Got a lot of Sudafed and vitamin C in my body right now. Feeling good. A lot of caffeine, but we're making it through the week.
I think we're both loading up on caffeine because this is going to be one of our longer episodes. Went pretty hard this week for a couple of reasons we'll talk about, but basically I put way more time into putting together the show notes for this episode than I have in the past, and I'm expecting the show to go a little bit longer than we usually do, and if that's something that bothers you, you know, if you like our typical, like, right under an hour format, why don't you write us an email? Andre, you want to tell them our email address?
Yes, hackersblackerpod@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Twitter @hackerspod, just tweet at us. We will respond to you.
Yeah, and another thing that we're doing with our Twitter now is as I add stories to the show notes, I send out tweets from the Twitter account about them. So, like, for example, this week, second I learned about the new Apple event that I'll talk about in the news section, I sent out a tweet from our Twitter account. So if you follow us @HackersPod, is that what it is, @HackersPod?
@HackersPod, yes.
Yeah, if you follow us @HackersPod, then you will get that news. I'd recommend turning on the notifications if you're really into this stuff, because basically what me and Andre do is we have a ton of notifications on for getting, like, basically the river of all of the tech stories that come out, and then we kind of condense them down into the ones that we think will interest you guys, the ones that we think are more important, and then we tweet them back out ourselves with a little bit about them, a link to them, and then telling you that we'll be talking about them on our show on Thursday. So give us a follow @HackersPod. We'd really appreciate it. And probably in the near future, the next couple weeks, we'll be running some sort of a giveaway there. So definitely get ready for that. Okay, so the first piece of follow-up we have is Apple rewarded the person who discovered the FaceTime bug last week. So the FaceTime bug was the thing that allowed you to get the audio of any device through FaceTime, which was really sketchy. And basically the story as of last week was that this 14-year-old discovered the bug while messing around, and the mom was upset because she had some problems reporting the bug. Like, Apple kept redirecting her to a bunch of other places, like their bug tracker and stuff like that, and she was upset because they didn't get anything for it. You know, typically companies will reward this sort of thing so that people don't sell them to bad actors. But as of this week, they paid out a bounty and actually set up some funds for the 14-year-old's college tuition. So I thought that was the right thing to do and kind of helped remedy that situation because they were getting a little bit of bad press over that.
Yeah, I really like the idea of companies paying out bounties for people finding bugs in their own systems. It's really helps promote white hat hacking over aggressive and malicious hacking, and I think that is just generally a really good thing for software and tech in general.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few angles to it. Like, so there's these people who are white hat hackers who discover these bugs. And it's kind of a good thing when they're the ones that discover them, because instead of selling them out to people who would maybe use those bugs for malicious reasons, exploits, they kind of get rewarded by these companies to report them so that type of stuff doesn't happen. So that's, it's a pretty interesting industry and something maybe we'll do a deep dive into sometime. The next thing I want to follow up on is I've listened to all my podcasts over the week and I got everyone's hot takes on the big Spotify acquisitions last week. So one of the themes that I saw were that people said, yes, like, Spotify will be able to create this new content, but a lot of people didn't really see it the same way me and you do, where it's like the start of a content war, you know, because they just don't really see this as that much of a change from what already exists. So some things I learned about were like Stitcher is a podcasting app that also has its own premium service where they do some exclusive shows, some shows that are exclusive for a period of time. Spotify already had pre-existing shows. Definitely nothing as popular as what Gimlet's brought to the table. But one of the bigger things that people in the industry were afraid of was kind of the combination of Gimlet and Anchor, because Anchor's that creation platform with 40% of new podcasts going through them. That is what kind of puts them in position to kind of YouTube up the industry, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think nothing I feel like we were pretty on point with what we said last week. Nothing I heard really contradicted us too much. I'm definitely just more confident in the fact that there's going to be like a big rush on like new original podcasts from maybe not Apple because they just operate that directory right now, but I bet they will get into it eventually, but definitely between like the existing players. So yeah, now we're going to get into the news. Up first, I already mentioned it, Apple has an event scheduled for March 25th at the Steve Jobs Theater. So this event is said to be subscription services focused. And if when we think about, like, there's pretty low details about this event. BuzzFeed just kind of broke that they had sources saying that this is going to happen. And what I think is a possibility for the event, everyone thinks it's going to be Apple Video, their Netflix competitor, however they're going to brand that, we don't really know. And then also there's been some buzz about Apple's upcoming news subscription service this week, which is kind of like a aggregate of subscriptions to a bunch of different news outlets. There's some articles coming out that Apple's getting pushback because it's asking for too high of a cut from the news companies. And I mean, it's the news companies posting that news, so yeah. It might have been a little bit of negotiating on their strategy, but I think it shows that it's something Apple is definitely actively pursuing if people are complaining about it. So it'll be an interesting event. This is definitely an area that there's a lot of pressure on Apple to perform in right now. But I will definitely keep my eyes out to see what their offerings are for the video side of things. I'm assuming that's what they're going to talk about. I'm hoping that's what they're going to talk about because I'm a lot more interested in that.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun to see what Apple actually decides to do when it comes to video. They really have quite the opening to go for it. They operate over a billion devices actively each day around the world that can show video and that can have native support for their own video player. And if you make it just that much easier for people to watch video, and if you get good content, it could go really well.
Yeah, and the reason we know about this service is because they've had to report like all this money that they're spending on content. So it should be interesting to see how their content game is, you know, if they can actually compete with like the Netflix original content. Like, heck, you know, Roma, Netflix original content up for Best Picture.
I actually just watched at least part of it. It's a very slow movie, so I started watching it, but I started pretty late in the night, and I was like, I'm not going to stay up for this entire movie. But
yeah, I watched it. I watched it too. It was definitely very artsy, not something we would have expected to see as a Netflix original a couple years ago. You know, they're definitely broadening their horizons.
Yeah, and I don't think you're going to see Apple making bad content. That's not what Apple does. They don't spend all this money to make things that are bad, per se. They will make it high quality, at least. It could still not be good content. There have been very bad devices that they've released. But Apple takes a lot of care into making things look good, at least.
Well, one of the things they did that is kind of an indicator of how this could go is their Planet of the Apps, I think it was called, that series on Apple Music. Did you ever watch it?
I did not watch that.
So they put out a TV show that was basically Shark Tank for apps, produced by Apple, Apple Music exclusive. So the way it was set up was that the person pitching starts at the top of an escalator, and it's an escalator pitch because they have until the escalator hits the bottom to pitch their app.
Interesting.
Gary Vee was one of the people on it, if I'm not mistaken. Will.i.am was definitely one of the people on it. So it was interesting. Didn't get a ton of positive feedback, but from the few episodes I watched, it was definitely like in the same ballpark quality-wise as Shark Tank. I just don't think, you know, putting that, and then they also had Carpool Karaoke on Apple Music, so getting those two shows alone isn't, like, enough to be a video service, but it was definitely a couple good test pilots for them making their own content.
A lot of people are going to make a lot of money on a lot of production teams for Apple.
For sure, yeah. They're going to be handing out some cash. So our next story is about Wells Fargo. You know, their streak of bad luck and bad PR continues as basically all of their systems went down earlier this week.
Yeah, it's Wells Fargo is just starting to get over some of that PR disaster that they had with the fake accounts from a couple years back.
Reestablished in 2018.
Yes, you know? They've got this whole marketing platform that they're using where they're trying to essentially be like, we are so sorry, we replaced everybody at the top. Let's try this again. And then they tried it again and everything broke.
Yeah, so when I was doing research on this event, I guess there wasn't a lot of solid articles out yet when I was looking into it, but there was a Reddit thread that had someone who said they had firsthand knowledge of the database. So basically it was a Wells Fargo employee.
Yeah, I'm reading this right now.
Posting it from the database, talking about how the fire suppression systems went off in their main data center. So basically that's where all of their online services lived. And what happened was there was a fire or just one of these systems malfunctioned. They had to shut it down. And what happens in these big organizations is you don't have just like backups of files. You know, you have backups of entire data centers.
Yeah,
so there's
yeah.
like duplicate data centers that the stuff is supposed to fail over to due to some malfunction. The systems were not able to fail over. One of the great hashtags I saw out of this was hashtag too big to fail over.
I did see that hashtag from... personally following the Hacker Slacker account, and you tweeted that from the Hacker Slacker account.
Too big to fail over. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah,
so
that's
basically
a good one.
What these things are supposed to do is fail over to a smaller system, and then that system, the backup system, is supposed to take over and provide the services. But something happened there where it couldn't do that, and their web portal, their ATMs were down, and temporarily people were getting credit card things declined, and they were like, I was watching the tweet stream about this for a little bit, and there were people talking about, like, I'm diabetic, like, what if I needed to get sugar when I was out, like, this could have killed me, like, just people were pissed about this, so, terrible PR.
Very bad PR, and this lasted way longer than it should have. They obviously didn't have fail-safes in place properly. They obviously didn't test their fail-safes properly.
Yeah, whatever happened, it was just some bug in the failover that, you know, it can happen to some people, but if you're a company like Wells Fargo, you don't really want to skimp in the IT department at this point. You can't afford too many big hits because, you know, now there's all these outrage of like, oh, you're going to charge me all this money when I fail to pay this on time, but you don't let me use my debit card. Where's my fee? You know, like people were just absolutely outraged. So
it'll be interesting to see if as a repercussion from part of that disaster that they had with the fake accounts, they did have to pay out a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And if they cut some of that money from IT funds.
Yeah. I mean, I saw a thread on this that was like, it's incredible that a company this big can't afford better IT talent. And then the reply to it was like, I mean, do you want to go work for Wells Fargo?
Yeah.
No. Like nobody wants to work for that system.
I don't think anybody wants to work IT for Wells Fargo, especially.
Yeah. So it's not like it's a problem that they can solve entirely just with their money. So, I mean, obviously they're in a bit of a hole.
Yeah, and from this Reddit thread that you were talking about earlier, it seems like even, like, internal teams at Wells Fargo this guy says, my team is 100% dead in the water, as many others are as well. DNS servers are down. So, basically, all of their file hosting, all of their access to everything went down.
Uh-huh. Just an absolute nightmare. So, yeah. This was something that kind of didn't give me like PTSD flashbacks, but just reminded me of something that people were constantly afraid of at my last internship at SIBO. So SIBO operates financial exchanges, and they have probably very similar backup requirements to Wells Fargo. So, you know, like obviously, I'm not going to talk about like the specific implementations, but like if you're operating an exchange out of a city, you even have to have backups that are of that exchange, you know, wired into that data center that are outside of that city. So like if there was a city-sized disastrous event, you could back up off-site to that new data center. So like there's tons of requirements that these companies are supposed to fill out, and from the teams that I worked on and the things that I saw, SIBO had a great system for doing this stuff. Like, it was so intense. So, I mean, like, they get a call that something happened on a main exchange, and they're like, did we fail over successfully? Yes, we failed over successfully. Okay, it's a code red, but, like, we can still operate out of the secondary exchange.
Yeah. At Google, they kind of showed us, like, where the data centers were and how many services were on each one and how many times a service was replicated. Mm-hmm. There were some services who are on, like, 13 different backups because Google has 7 services that have a billion users, which it's pretty big. Like, they cannot fail on these. It's one of those things where it's, like, besides having no Wi-Fi, have you ever seen the Google error page on the Google search?
Yeah, exactly.
You just don't, because they have it so secure. And a lot of companies, focus a lot on being that secure. And this just kind of shows that Wells Fargo was pretty negligent in that area.
Yeah, I mean, as a programmer, I found some of the stuff interesting. Like, it didn't make me think, like, I want to do this as a career, but if this is stuff that inspires you, like, there's tons of stuff out there.
Absolutely.
And it's like, okay, so you have a backup of a system that's like, so like if you have a data center, there's probably two systems so that if one in that data center goes down, you can fail over to the other one in that data center that's mm-hmm. in the same space. Oh, well, what if the whole data center is like broke by an earthquake? Well, we're yeah. gonna go over here. Oh, and you have to think about what happens if the electricity's cut off. Well, you have all these batteries, like
yeah.
redundancy on redundancy on redundancy. It's just crazy.
Yeah, and you sometimes it's like, oh, you have to have something in rural Washington and yep. something in Iowa because yep. there may be tornadoes all over the Midwest, but you can go up to Washington and get that data.
Yeah, so it's interesting stuff. Okay, so now to get into our next story about Apple again. Apple is cracking down on this analytic style that some apps were using where it would essentially record your interactions with the app like you had some sort of a screen recorder running. So the way that these apps pitch themselves is that it would kind of show developers how users use their app so they can better design them and get a lot of this data. And the way they were implemented is a developer would kind of use this service's code in their app so that the service would get the data and then present it back to the developer. So it's like a third-party library. And these services were able to run on iOS without asking for user permission for doing this sort of thing. It didn't, like, so when you get a pop-up of like, oh, I'd like to access your contacts, they didn't have to pop up and say, oh, can we record your screen and monitor your every action? You know, it's just like, yeah. it's in the code, they can do it. And so obviously it's a GDPR violation not to ask, but a lot of this stuff goes on anyways. And so there was a big story in TechCrunch kind of outing this sort of practice. And then again, a day later, we saw Apple saying, okay, we're going to crack down on this. So this is a pattern yeah. that we've seen a couple times now where TechCrunch is like, hey, there's this huge problem. And Apple's like, hey, we see it now. We're going to fix it. So it's just like, it's kind of crazy how this media cycle's yeah. been working with this and the FaceTime bug both went over the exact same way.
Yeah, I've got like three thoughts on that. One is a quick thought on like how the media can influence the way tech works so mm-hmm. quickly nowadays, because there are media outlets designated to like watch over these companies, and a lot, unlike say political reporters, the stuff can move really fast. They can find a bug and fix it within a day or two. Sometimes they can find a bug and fix it within an hour. And a lot of times these media companies will say, hey, we found this bug, we're not going to report it. I think that happened with a Microsoft security bug at one point a couple years ago, is that they had found a bug in the system, reported it to Microsoft. Microsoft fixed it, and then they reported on it, but also said, hey, Microsoft fixed this as soon as we,
yeah.
As soon as we told them. So it's really interesting to see that dependency on each other.
Yeah, a third example of this was last week we talked about Apple like and the research apps that yes. Facebook and Google were using.
Mm-hmm.
Exact same thing. TechCrunch says, oh, we're going to do this big expose on these articles that are doing all, or on these apps that are doing this crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Next day, Apple's like, oh, hey, we're going to revoke their access
yeah.
to these apps that do this crazy stuff. It's interesting how much power the media has over kind of protecting our privacy, you know?
Yeah. And so then I also had a technical thought and a business thought
yep.
here, where it's like, it's really interesting to see what is going to happen with these apps after they lose these access to analytics, because I think we're going to at least see some apps come up with like these brilliant new analytics tools that they can embed within their own application, right? So that they don't have to screen record, but that they come up with by themselves to more easily analyze information that they get without invading your privacy that much. I don't really know how that solution would work, but I feel like there will be apps that are able to implement something like that. And then also for Apple, they've really been pushing security ever since they started putting the dedicated security chips into their phones and iPads and laptops. This TechCrunch article has the what happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone, which is
that billboard we talked about.
Yeah, the billboard outside of CES. They don't go to CES, but they put a billboard outside of it. So they're really focused on security, and I think, especially after that FaceTime bug, they're getting even more aggressive. And so I'm kind of glad that they are, because I use Apple products and I care about my data privacy.
Yeah, so one of the, this was kind of like the Facebook thing in that this is technically against Apple's pre-existing rules. It just was not brought to their attention until it showed up in the media. So now Apple is saying like, hey, like, we know who you are now. Like, we are going to take this down if you don't ask for permission. So a lot of this style of stuff is, you know, recording these user interactions with the app so they can see like, oh, maybe it took someone way too long to get through this part of the sign-up screen. Maybe we need to rethink this because they just kept tapping on this button that wasn't supposed to be enabled yet or something like that. That sort of stuff is allowed to exist. They just have to ask you first. And then an interesting response to that is because only users who give permission to that kind of stuff are allowed to be tracked, and that's information that developers use to design the apps. Apps are being designed towards people who don't care about their data. Yeah. It's like, I'm the one that's going to give permission to track my screen. Well, I'm the only one you have tracking data on, so you're going to kind of optimize it towards me and not towards the person who clicked no.
Yeah, and it's that trade-off that you make for your data security. If you're knowledgeable when you're going through signups, when you're downloading software from the internet on what you should and shouldn't accept, it will make it so that you can have a good software experience while also protecting your data. But that takes a lot of time and energy to know like what everything's asking for and who has what data that you've given out. And especially with Google and Facebook and Amazon, it's really difficult to know like how much of your data is out there.
Yeah. And one of the scary parts about these sorts of analytics tools was that the type of data that they're getting, if they're in certain implementations, if they're doing the full, like, we're just going to record sessions of your screen. If you typed in a credit card, if you typed in some sensitive information, that could show up on the screen recording. So now all of a sudden, you know, maybe you were using like this. I don't think that this was an actual, you know, issue. So I'll just use an example of an app that I use. Like if you're using Bank of America and you have to type in your credit card to sign into your account, and Bank of America is using, you know, like, analytics tool.io for their analytics. Now all of a sudden analytics tool.io has your bank account information in their databases. And that's like not something that you ever really thought of, but you know, if they get breached, now all of a sudden that's another point where your stuff can come up. And those were like fake examples with fake companies, but that's the general idea, is like this data is now data that you didn't know you gave up because you didn't think anyone was watching your screen, and it's being held by someone you didn't know who had it. So like if they resell this data, if they do other stuff like that. And then the other thing I want to talk about is how this is stuff that has existed for a long time on the web. And on the web, there's no one to say you have to ask for permission for this sort of thing, until GDPR, obviously. But
yeah,
this kind of behavior tracking is like a common thing when you're trying to kind of optimize your user's experience. You know, you kind of want to watch how they're using it. So
yeah, and I don't think a lot of these software systems are designed with all of this analytics power tools as a malicious thing. I mean, I honestly think they really just want to make the best app, and they want to, but a lot of times they don't protect the data properly, and they don't gather the data in a secure or ethical way.
Yeah, and a lot of times they probably just didn't think about the downsides. Like, I mean, I have no problem if an app, you know, sometimes they do that pop-up that's like, can we send information back to us for like debugging reasons, and I'm like so like if they want to if they want to track how I'm using my weather app, I don't really care. But if they're going to take screen recordings of me and my bank app when I'm entering in personal information, like obviously that's just something that Apple should not allow. So
and after like being a programmer, you kind of realize like getting these analytics and getting these bug reports is super important. I've done some debugging, and it's just that stuff's super important. But that's a lot on data security. That could be a whole podcast in itself.
And one of our upcoming news stories later this episode, we'll talk more about data security, so get ready to come back to these thoughts. Next is something way out of left field that I totally forgot about, but Amazon is kind of peddling around previews of their first video game that's actually going to be released.
Yeah, I had no idea this was happening. Like, I think there's a vague memory of me hearing something about that, and then I saw the tweet. I was like, whoa, It's there. It doesn't super surprise me, but I wasn't really expecting it.
So 5 years ago when we were in, what grade would that have been? Like
5 years ago, we'd have been early high school.
Early high school. They announced that they were going to be kind of getting into the gaming industry. And then a year later, one of the first fruits of this labor was that they forked a popular game engine, which is like something you would use to make video games. And they were like, okay, we're going to make our own one of these. And it's called Lumberyard. And it's a kind of like free-to-use way to produce video games that Amazon puts out and supports. And so they also said they were going to make video games. They announced two games. A few years later, they canceled one of them, and this is the second game that apparently they've been working on this whole time, and it's now set to be released. It is called New World, and it's a sandbox MMO. If you're familiar with video games, it kind of reminds me of like an Ark or like a Rust or something like that. It's set in like medieval times. Basically, you're plopped down in this world with other players. You can team up to form teams. Build bases, collect resources. If you die, you lose all your stuff. You know, you fight in these, you can fight other players, that sort of things. You know, like, it's totally sandbox, not really based around story. But yeah, kind of a crazy thing. It feels like maybe they redoubled their efforts after the success of Fortnite, right? Mm-hmm. Because Fortnite was something that was put out by a maker of a game engine. They have their own game engine. They're like, all right, screw it. Like, let's just put up some big, massively multiplayer online thing, see if we can get a hit out of this technology that we've been developing for the last 6 years, you know?
Yeah, I mean, does it really surprise you that Amazon's building games? I don't think it surprises anybody.
Nope.
Amazon could do pretty much anything as part of their business strategy, and I would not be surprised.
Yep. I mean, I think that if now Amazon starts acquiring video game companies, I don't know, like, it'll be interesting to see how much farther they can push before they get into antitrust laws.
Yeah,
you know?
let's
like,
see.
This is all stuff they're doing internally as of right now, mm-hmm. So I think that they can just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's Amazon. What else?
Another big thing kind of in the Fortnite-y area that I don't have in the show notes, but that I saw just before this podcast started, was that EA put out kind of a Fortnite-y-style Battle Royale game. And in 1 week, it got to 25 million users.
Man.
Which was absolutely wild. Like, if you compare that, someone plotted it next to Fortnite's user growth, and, like, it way surpassed the popularity that Fortnite got in the week after its release. So, look out, Epic. I guess EA is coming for you with a new game. And, if it's a huge hit, I'm sure you'll hear more about it here, but...
Yep.
There's been a lot of these types of like Fortnite clone games, and it's just kind of crazy that this one had so much success so quickly.
Yeah.
The next story I have here is from Quartz. It's about the rise of automatic license plate readers, which is not a topic I ever thought I would research into. It's exactly what you're thinking about. It's kind of like a roadside camera that will report your license plate, maybe the speed you were traveling, and when you think about these things, you think about them being owned by police. You know, obviously this is stuff that they're called ALRPs. ALRP companies sell these to police so that they can do speed traps, so that they can look out for vehicles that they're trying to track down, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And for some reason, something's happened in the industry where over the last 2 years, 90,000 new ones were installed, 3,000% increase from 2 years ago, and around half of these newly installed ALRPs are owned by private citizens. So that's got some privacy researchers kind of interested in what's going on in this space. You know, why are we seeing private companies trying to track our license plates?
Yeah, I've heard that there are a lot of privacy concerns with these devices.
Yeah, so these devices can capture, you know, 4-lane highway, 2,000 license plates a minute, going up to 120 miles an hour. So, I mean, they're going to get this data. And there's a lot of rules when the police have to use these. You know, each state has its own laws around how they can implement these. But if you're a private citizen, you know, recording plates on private property, or maybe you set up one of these in your house, aiming at your street in front of your house, like, there's no regulations. You can do whatever you want with that data that you're collecting.
Yeah, and I mean, really the only time that I've seen any use out of these is when I'm driving north, when you go through Sioux City, which is like where Nebraska, Iowa, and South Dakota meet, if you're not from the Midwest. If you're driving through Sioux City, they have those along their interstate. They have speed traps without cops, which, from what I've heard, everybody hates, because they'll just mail you a ticket.
Yeah, I don't think they're legal in every state either.
No, they're not, because it's as soon as you get to South Dakota that you can get a ticket mailed to your house because you were speeding. I don't know, like, what the limit is for when they send you a ticket. I've definitely been going a little bit over the speed limit and never gotten a ticket from that. But, yeah, sorry, South Dakota, but not a huge fan of those.
Yeah, so with these systems becoming more affordable, companies can easily purchase them, and they're affordable for private citizens as well. You can even kind of do your own DIY one where you just get a internet-connected camera, point it at the street, and then hook it up to, like, a software services that'll analyze the video for you and detect the license plates just with, like, machine learning and stuff. So I was trying to think what types of people would use these. So there's your neighborhood guy who's super concerned about the safety of the neighborhood.
Yeah, your neighborhood watch kind of guy.
Your neighborhood watch guy might put one of these on the street, you know, maybe do his own little looking out for suspicious cars, looking out for cars speeding, you know, so he can go snitch on his neighbors or something like that. Or, like, even crazier, and something that I would be curious to know if this is actually happening. I couldn't really find anything in the article about it. They said that some businesses are buying them, but I want to see if, like, the McDonald's Corporation is setting these up in their parking lots so they can track their users. You know?
I mean, it's definitely, like, I can see the, like, neighborhood watch kind of guy. I can see independent researchers who are trying to get just data on traffic. And obviously there are government agencies who are going to use these, but privately, it gives companies that aren't software-based a much easier way to track the people. And I don't know, like, how available a lot of the information on the actual license plates are, but...
Yeah, so anytime you run these plate numbers, things that they said it could return is, like, the year, model, and color of the car, based on the registration information that's publicly available. And so, like, if you were the McDonald's Corporation, I think you could, you know, set one of these up in your parking lot and see, like, start to track your customers from location to location, like, see which ones they're going to, you know, maybe, like, they opened up a new location, they want to see, like, what percentage of customers they're taking from other locations.
Yeah.
I just think that there's all these crazy online tracking, and companies are kind of, companies with brick and mortar locations are trying to figure out, you know, how can we be smarter with our in-person analytics?
Yeah.
And I think setting up these in parking lots could be a way to be like, okay, let's figure out our users, you know, maybe we can relate these to the information we have online. All of a sudden we're tracking which users are showing up at which locations, how often, you know, maybe how many people are in their family that show up in these cars. Like, there's a whole crazy future, you know, and possible startup ideas around getting this data from, you know, license plates and parking lots and letting companies play with it, you know.
And if I could slip on my conspiracy hat real quick, I'm going to take this hat off and put on my conspiracy hat. Get a little bit more sinister. It's going to give a lot of creeps a lot easier way to stalk people.
Oh, yeah.
They can see the name of the registrant on the car, and if they are stalking somebody and you give them the information that they can find from their license plate registration, and it could get even worse, but we'll keep it light. I'll take my conspiracy hat off from there, but yeah, it could give a lot of people a lot of power that they shouldn't have.
Well, in the place where this power becomes kind of too great is that there's limits placed on what the police force can do with this technology, but if, you know, 70% of private citizens are setting these up in front of their houses, there's not limits on, like, the information the police force can buy. So let's say someone comes together and says, like, hey, if you install this camera in front of your house, I'll give you X amount of dollars a month. They're collecting this information from private locations, selling them back to the police for a profit. Now all of a sudden the police have this network, and the government has this network of where everybody is at all times based on their cars, you know?
Yeah, I would think that the best way to regulate this would be put the same government regulations that are on government agencies onto private citizens, force licensing, make sure that maybe private citizens can't buy them if they're not part of like a company that very clearly states why they need it, or if they're not doing like research that they can very clearly state exactly why they're using it.
Or just like you can't point it at not your private property. Yeah. You know, you can point it at the road in front of your house. If you're a business, maybe you can put it in your parking lot because that's yours, but not on public roads. As it exists right now, you know, not with this, you know, taking our conspiracy hats off, what's really out there right now does not concern me too much. I don't have a huge expectation of privacy around when I'm out in the public streets.
Yeah. You know? I don't expect us to get all Brave New World in like 5 years. Yeah. But...
And I mean, stoplights have video cameras on them already. Like if they want to figure out where I'm driving, I don't have any reasonable expectation that exactly where I drive is hidden from the government. So, not super concerned about this in the short term. Something that could lead to Skynet in the long term is the way I'll put it. But yeah, so speaking of crazy, futuristic, possibly spooky technology, Google Maps put out a preview of their Google Maps AR features in their apps. And it's kind of exactly the way I'd been picturing this. And it's just as crazy as I thought it would be. So basically, the way it would work is you're in your Google Maps app, you're saying, I'm on the streets, you know, I'm on the downtown streets of Seattle, I want to go to the nearest Starbucks. Well, it's 0.3 miles away.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, sometimes when you look at that map, it's hard to tell which direction your dot is facing. Do I need to go this way or this way? Well, you can tap the button that says, you know, view in AR, point your phone at the street. The phone, you have to wave it around a little bit to kind of calibrate where it is. Once your phone gets its orientation, arrows will appear through the camera in front of you and show you which direction to walk. And then it'll, when you get to the store, like if, let's say you're going to like an office that's down an alleyway, it'll point you down the alleyway, or if it's like a multi-level thing, it can give you a little marker in 3D space of where the location is that you're going.
Yeah. I've been really excited since they announced that feature. I mean, being in a big city, a lot of the times you can try to route yourself to a location. And if you're walking, you can just walk right past it if it's not super clearly labeled. And then you're like, oh no, where am I? Because sometimes the location is just a little bit off. But this would be really nice because I can tell you for sure, there's some places I went in San Francisco where it's like it was at the top of a building, but it wasn't labeled at the bottom of the building that the place I was going was at the top of that building. So I would go like a block too far and not even realize that I had gone too far. So this will be really nice to test out.
Yeah. So I think dense urban areas is a good use case for this.
Yeah.
And then in the future, when Google's built up some more of its indoor mapping, you know, like airports, subways, things where there's not like strict streets to follow, you could kind of get a better idea of where you need to head, you know, which door you need to take just by looking through your phone.
Yeah. And I will actually be working on Google Maps user-facing bugs this summer.
Interesting.
So hopefully I'll get to deal with this stuff a little bit.
That would be sweet. Yeah, so it's still under heavy development, so there's still a lot of work to be done on it. Like, they haven't really settled on the way the navigation is going to work. In the article, it said, like, it used to be, like, they tested out having like a pizza delivery guy in AR that you're following around. So you kind of, you're following like a tour guide telling you where to go. But one of the issues that they wanted to combat was people just staring through their phones. So basically the way it works is if you lift your phone up to your face, like you were going to take a picture, it'll go into AR mode and know that you're looking around. And then if you put it back down, maybe like you're reading a text message where it's horizontal, it'll go back into regular maps mode. And after a certain amount of time with the phone in front of your face in AR mode, it'll just go into regular maps mode because it's like, hey, idiot, watch where you're walking. You know? So yeah, I thought this was really cool. I have been thinking about stuff like this for a while. There's some cool apps out there that do this sort of thing. Like, me and my friend were messing around with this like niche, like a AR social network thing that would put a pin above your friend's head, and it had a similar thing where you could like, so like if my friend is across campus in another building, I could see him on a map normal when my phone's horizontal, and then when my phone's vertical, it would like show a little dot in 3D space of where they are and how far away that is, and a little arrow of how to get there.
Yeah, I mean, this is just an awesome feature. It's super cool to see it natively supported within Google Maps.
Yep. Yeah. It's tech that's coming, and it's exactly the type of thing that when Google does it, it will be mainstream and it'll be sweet.
Yeah.
And this is a great head start for them for when glasses come.
That's exactly where I was going to go.
Because
next.
When glasses come, this is exactly what you'll want. You know, yes. You won't want to be looking at a map. You want to be looking at what you're looking at, and you'll want to be seeing things in 3D space. And this is just a great head start for them in that area.
And if you remember, about a year ago, there was a software update for Google Glass. They put out a new update that I don't really know what it did, but they updated the software. It's still supported. I don't know a single person who's ever really touched Google Glass, but
I saw them. Someone wore them to my high school one time.
Interesting.
So I put it on my face. So I wore Google Glass.
Dang. And I really think that we're getting to a point in technology where we will be able to support that, right? Because Apple made the Newton, right? Mm-hmm. But then they made the iPad.
Yep,
I have a feeling we're going to get the iPad of Google Glasses sometime in the next 5 years.
I agree. I have been kind of evangelizing that on the show, but it is definitely one of my like core beliefs about the near future of technology, that smartphones are not going to be like the final stage device. No. That we're going to move towards some glasses-based
thing. Watches, wearables, yep, that kind of stuff.
Contacts, you know, yes. Whatever it is. Like, just even more seamless ways to interact with technology, and you know, from a lot of perspectives, it makes a lot of sense. But you know, we'll save some talk about that sort of thing for a different show.
Yes.
Okay. We are at our last news segment. I think that we're at the length of like a normal podcast right now.
We're at 42 minutes right now.
So yeah, this is, like I said, settle in. You know, we're at our last news segment. We're almost there.
Yep.
And this is one that, some of you guys might not know what this company is, but the company Eero was acquired by Amazon this week. And it is an interesting acquisition because what Eero is it's one of the most popular providers of mesh Wi-Fi networks.
Yes.
And if you listen to other podcasts, you've probably heard of them. They sponsor a lot of podcasts, but what they do is they let you set up different devices, like so you have your regular router and then you have other points plugged into walls throughout the house, and it kind of relays the Wi-Fi around the house.
It essentially gives you a giant blanket of Wi-Fi.
Yep.
So every point in your house has even powerful Wi-Fi. I've been trying to convince my mom to get this kind of Wi-Fi for several years. I know she's listening and she's probably thinking, oh, that's exactly what he's been talking about. So yeah, Eero makes these mesh Wi-Fi network systems that basically allow you to disperse your Wi-Fi better throughout your house, because you can have super powerful Wi-Fi, but if the way your house is set up isn't conducive to your router that you have set up, in maybe your office is in a weird spot in your house, if your house is too big, it can be really difficult to have good Wi-Fi throughout your house.
Yeah, so this has kind of been the hot new thing in Wi-Fi routers. The only real big innovation we've seen recently. Google has its own system for this. My family back at home used Orbi, which was owned by Netgear. So there's all sorts of these things out there. And, you know, you look at why Amazon would buy this sort of thing. What they said was that they are trying to be the leading provider of, like, in-home smart devices, and that Eero is a great way to connect all those in-home smart devices.
There you go.
And when I look at this, I say, yes, that makes sense. But what also makes sense is all of that beautiful data that is going to be going to all of these Amazon devices.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your Alexa set up that you talk to. Your Alexa talks to your now Amazon-owned router, and then it talks back to all of your in-home devices. But the router is like everything in your house's access point to the internet.
Yeah.
So obviously they're not going to just like start selling all your data, you know, like that'd be crazy. People would hate that. Everyone would freak out. But they can do, you know, more subtle things. There's a feature in the Eero app that lets you see like devices on your network, and it'll make a guess of like what types of devices are connected to your network.
Yeah.
And so one thing that I heard on ATP, one of the big tech podcasts, was that one of the hosts had this idea of, if it can see what types of devices are on your network, they can see, if you're a Mac owner, you're pretty likely to own a PS4, or you're pretty likely own a Switch if you also have Windows PCs. You know, if you have this type of smart light, you know, usually on this type of hub.
Yeah.
And then what does Amazon do? They sell all these things.
Yes.
So they can use that to target, you know, better ads to you and say, like, this and that. So there is a little bit of kickback from the tech industry. You know, a lot of people just kind of groaned, like, oh, we're giving more data away to Amazon.
Yeah.
I don't like this. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see exactly what they do with this. It's not like they will be able to see, like, all of your bank account information when you log into your bank. You know, a lot of this, most modern sites right now are SSL encrypted, which is, you know, when HTTPS is at the front of your address and you have that little lock icon next to the URL.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. They couldn't see all the information that's going through there.
Yep. And most browsers will tell you if you're going to a non-encrypted site as well.
Yep. So the internet's been getting better at that. So it'll kind of mitigate what they're able to do from that respect, but there are plenty of angles that Amazon can use. You know, maybe they sell the normal Eero to you, like, at a price, but they offer Eero at a discount, kind of like they do with their Kindle devices, if maybe they can insert their own ads into your browsing experience, you know, like their special offers category of devices. A special offers router would be kind of scary.
Yeah.
And on top of that, Eero already has an existing service called Eero Plus that kind of watches sites you visit and checks for sites that are known, like, bad actors. So, like, let's say you have Eero Plus enabled on your router. You go to, like, downloadmoreram.com. It'll be like, this site is a virus site. Like, please get away. So they already have services where they are providing value to customers by being able to see exactly the sites that they're visiting.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. I have one more story that broke just a couple hours ago as of recording. I put it in the notes so you can pull it up.
This is a fun headline. Is this the one with the fun headline?
This is the SEC charges formal Apple compliance lawyer with insider trading.
Yeah.
So this guy was in charge of making sure that nobody did any sort of insider trading, and he was just charged with insider trading.
Yeah, there's this great quote. A formal Apple lawyer who is supposed to keep employees from insider trading has been charged with insider trading.
Yes. So I saw that. I saw that. I got the notification like an hour before we started recording, and I just thought it was hilarious. I just found the story on Twitter, and so I thought we should talk about it really briefly. Just Apple's talking about all this security stuff, and then they get hit with another bad PR move. Although,
I don't know how much this one's going to break into the mainstream consumers.
Yeah.
Like, he's obviously, like, the former. He's not even, like, a current Apple person, but it is kind of a gross situation. One of the things that people who talk about Apple a lot will sometimes mention is that there's kind of this cycle where the new iPhones are released in the fall, and then in January a bunch of articles come out. You know, maybe they don't start in the most reputable places, maybe their sources are, like, overseas manufacturers saying, you know, we're seeing less iPhone production than we saw last year. The iPhone's not selling well. The iPhone XR is not selling well. And then you see the stock price go down.
Mm-hmm.
And then when earnings season comes around, Apple puts out their report and it's like, oh, actually the iPhone's selling really well. And then you see the stock price go back up. So there's this idea that a lot of people who report on Apple have, that there's kind of not necessarily insider trading, but people using these articles to manipulate the value of Apple's stock price.
Yeah.
So this year people were banging that drum again, and it was kind of interesting. Like, you know, the people who I listened to were like, yeah, like, we've seen this before. People are saying the iPhone XR is not selling as well, but I'm sure it'll be fine. They're just doing the shady stuff where they're manipulating the stock price. And then Apple put out their reports, and it was like, oh, the iPhone XR is actually not selling
down.
Well. Like, they were actually right this time. So it's just been kind of an interesting thing that I never really realized about the Apple industry, is that there's possibly this whole shady industry around putting out negative articles about the iPhone to manipulate the price so that you can buy the dip. And then this year, those people turned out to be right.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's it for news. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Okay. So our main story today in this marathon episode is about this report that came out. It was a joint report from CB Insights and the New York Times. They had this special algorithm and they were determining which companies will be part of the next generation of unicorn startups. And I think we've mentioned it on the show, but what a unicorn is it's a company that is valued at over $1 billion.
Yes, that's a lot of money.
a lot of dollars. Not every company makes it to that stage, obviously. But when I think about unicorns, a lot of what I think about is like, you know, your Ubers, your Airbnbs, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And these are apps that are primarily like household names, you know, people use them all the time. And when you look at the services that people use in their day-to-day lives, you know, there's not a lot of them that aren't by or owned by companies that are valued at over $1 billion, you know?
I mean, one company I just saw is like a triple unicorn is DoorDash.
Yeah.
That I didn't even realize it was worth that much. I figured it might be a unicorn, but I saw that they had some funding led by Tencent out of China, which is a huge tech investment company in China, but that's a whole nother topic. Essentially, DoorDash is worth a lot of money.
Yeah, so the way that you kind of get these valuations is when investment rounds come out, information's posted about it, and based on how much the investment was for what percent of the company, the valuation of the company is determined, and you're a unicorn if that's over $1 billion. So that's kind of one of the things that me and Andre see a lot in the news, but we don't report on the show, is all of these investment rounds. You know, like I think half of the notifications I probably get are like X startup raised X amount of money. And a lot of times it's not very interesting unless it's like a all-out acquisition like Euro was. So basically this next wave of predicted unicorns aren't stuff that, you know, even when they reach this size, everyone's going to know. It's a lot more you know, niche areas. You know, maybe they support other companies, they're B2B, maybe they're for industries like farming, industries like biotech, you know, these companies that are, you know, the main industries, transportation, that sort of thing, have been brought to the digital world. And now we're seeing this wave of industries that were lagging behind being brought digital, but they're not industries that everyone uses on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, if you'll remember from our Product Hunt Breakout List episode that we did about a month ago or something, we talked about Flexport, which is a freight forwarding company.
Exactly.
That is a unicorn company, and they are worth that much money because they're bringing tech into a into an industry that really hasn't seen that much technological innovation, and because of that, they've completely taken over the industry.
Yeah, so this list was 50 companies. It had a ton of those sorts of things. I picked out, I think it's like 8 of them that I thought were interesting that I wanted to talk about on the show. And these are, they're pretty exciting. A couple of these companies I'd actually heard about before, but most of them were not news, or were news to me. And a lot of them, you know, they're industry specific, so me reading about them for 5 minutes couldn't tell me exactly what they do, but I'm going to give you kind of the high level view of these companies. And I kind of like these list episodes, so I hope you guys enjoy this too. And we're going to start with a company called Earnin, E-A-R-N-I-N. And this app, it looks pretty sleek and it is pretty high tech. And essentially what it is something that you do not usually associate with those two terms. It is a modern payday loans sort of situation.
Yeah, I'm reading through it right now. It looks very interesting and a lot less shady than a corner payday loan store.
Yeah, so obviously the payday loans industry is huge, and there's been some sort of pushes to get those industries, you know, get some apps in the hands of millennials where they can do this sort of thing. And I'm not really sure to what percentage shady this is. It puts on a pretty sleek exterior appearance. So basically the way that this app markets itself is that every day is payday, and the way it works is you hook up your bank accounts, you download this app that will track your location, and you tell it where you bank, where you work, and what it can do is it'll track how many hours you spend at work, and based on your wage that you input and it being able to see your past paychecks, you are able to cash out at the end of your workday. So if I am like an Apple Store employee and I go to work at Apple for 8 hours, this is Monday, if payday is on Friday, when I clock out of work, I can cash out on Monday. You know, I can get a part of my paycheck in advance, and it uses these analytics to kind of add another layer of trust to maybe make this a better deal for you because they're more confident that they see your paychecks coming in, they see you have regular income, they see you are at your work location for a certain amount of time. So then they believe that they're able to offer you this advance on what essentially is just a payday loan.
Yeah.
And then what happens at the end of the week is whatever amount you cashed out during the week is deducted from your paycheck when it's put into your account because they're hooked up to your bank account. So they just take it right out. And what it feels like to me is, because right now they're kind of doing it in a no fee, like just kind of give us a tip if you feel like it type of model. And yeah. What this feels like to me is it's very VC funded right now. They're not concerned about being profitable. They're just concerned about making more and more money. Mm-hmm. So likely there will be some sort of interest like there is on a normal loan eventually. But right now it's an interesting app. And yeah. If you're someone who has cash flow problems, you know, maybe you only get paid once a month, but you have an emergency come up and you need some cash right now. Well, it could be really good if you can cash out that app and, you know, get that extra cash flow in your life. So it might not necessarily be something that, you know, I would find super useful, but I could see this being something that, you know, could provide an essential service for people. And as long as, you know, the terms of it aren't too harsh, you know, you're not going to get absorbent fees or like terrible consequences if your paycheck doesn't end up coming in exactly when the app thinks you will. I could see this being a positive service for a lot of people.
Yeah, I can see it becoming a very positive service because it's very easy to use, it seems at least. They don't have any terrible fees at the moment.
It's leveraging technology in an interesting way.
I'm sure they're making some money off of all that data. Obviously, they're tracking you all day. Yeah. So they can be like, hey, this person works here, banks here, makes this much money. What are their patterns when they're walking around all day?
But so for some people, that's a great trade-off to make. You know, if I can cash out on my paycheck the second I earn that money, that
can be huge. And knowing that there are regulations in place to protect personal identifiable information, so nobody's going to know your exact address and workplace and income. That's great. However, there's still all of the ideas behind data still always leaks. You never know how secure a system truly is. And also, you don't want to develop a dependency on being able to spend your money before you've made it.
Exactly.
So that's important, but...
Because I didn't look into how harsh it is if maybe something happens and you lost your job and your paycheck doesn't come in. All of a sudden, are you going to start, you know, is the debt collector going to come to your door and bust your kneecaps?
Because it's like, when you have payday loans, it's because you are, you need to pay something off. But this makes it seem almost like, oh, hey, you want to go out to a bar on Thursday night before you get paid on Friday. You're just going to take some money out of what you would have earned. I don't think you really want to become dependent on that because it can lead to habits where if you don't have savings or a spending fund that you use for that, it won't be a very great idea.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very high percentage of people in America that are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
And if that's just your reality, if you don't have enough money to build up any sort of savings, you know, maybe this is a miracle app lifesaver so that you're able to pay for a medical expense that comes up in an emergency. But it was definitely one of the more interesting ones I saw on this list, you know, something that makes a lot of sense when you think about it, and is an industry that I haven't really seen a lot of innovation in. So the next app on this list is called Front. And the gist of it is that it is a kind of like think Slack for email. So it lets a team handle an inbox. So you can have, a certain number of members who can see an email inbox. You can assign, people to handle certain emails. If you're looking at an email, there's a little chat channel on the right side of it. So you can kind of ask questions to your coworkers about maybe how something needs to be handled or addressed. And then you can also see it kind of like pulls in information from, like, if your company uses Salesforce or maybe their Twitter information about the people that you're emailing with. So it's kind of just like a nice environment for teams to handle email, pulling in like interesting data and facilitating communication.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now and it really looks awesome. Like, it's very...
it's pretty slick.
Yeah, you can tell that like a startup would love this kind of technology.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you have 12 team members in your company, maybe you want everybody to be getting every email to a certain email address because maybe there's a bug and there's only 7 people in, and some, they email it to somebody who's out. They don't really have any other contact because it's a small company. There are just a lot of situations in which I can see this being super useful and giving a lot of access to a lot of people who know kind of similar stuff.
Yeah. Or if your company has like a 20-person customer support team,
yeah,
and you're constantly getting emails about like, how do I do this with the, you know, like just typical customer support emails, you can start assigning people to those emails and like have a cohesive system around how they get addressed. You know, I'm not saying stuff like this doesn't exist. I'm sure large companies have systems to handle this sort of thing, but they're kind of providing it for maybe smaller companies, smaller teams, doing it in a pretty innovative way. So if it's interesting to you, check out Front. And the next one we're going to talk about is one that I have a little bit less understanding on, which is kind of ironic because I've actually been to their offices before.
Oh, interesting.
The next one is called Marqeta. I went to their office in Oakland. That's where they're based out of. And what they are is a backend service and provider of highly customizable payment cards. So like when you think about like a company card, like a credit card or a debit card, they will allow you to issue physical cards, virtual cards, single-use cards for employees or customers. So they're used by some pretty big companies like Instacart, DoorDash, Square. It enables them to issue these cards quickly, kind of way quicker than an industry standard, and then see real-time information on how these cards are being used and place restrictions on them.
Yeah, I mean, corporate cards are huge. And being able to control them and customize them just makes sense.
Yeah, so they're just a nice backend for controlling corporate cards. They've had a lot of successful growth. Their offices were very nice. they were pretty nice. So I went on a Rakes trip. They were great to us. You know, they showed us around. Their CEO spent some time talking to us. There was a person who graduated from UNL who kind of talked about what it's like living in Silicon Valley, coming from the Midwest. So I had a pretty positive experience when I was there, and corporate cards, I'm assuming, is a massive industry, and that's why they're on this list.
Yeah.
So I guess congrats to them for being considered for this, but yeah. The next is Checkr, and it's another sort of business-enabling company that is kind of background checks as a service. So think... And this is a real example. If you're a driver and you want to sign up to be an Uber driver, when you get your background check, these are the people that actually handle that. So,
yeah, I think I've had one done through Checkr. Maybe. I don't know. I've had several background checks for different companies. I don't really know. They always send me an email. I don't really care about the company name.
Yeah.
Because it's not like they're going to say, oh, yeah, you don't need a background check. So, but I'm pretty sure I've had a background check done by these people.
I might have as well. They are, you know, normal background checks. It's something that you do when you're like applying for a job. But with these companies that have like, you know, gig drivers, like food delivery services, driving services, all these sorts of things, they have to check a lot of people, you know, who are randomly signing up for these things that aren't necessarily full-time employees.
Yeah.
So a service like this is kind of what's enabled these companies to grow safely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see why, you know, that gig economy is not going away. More and more people are going to work through these things. I can see why there's a lot of potential for a company like Checkr to grow. And when I was looking at their website, one of the companies in the companies that use this section was Zillow. So,
huh, nice.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So we are halfway through that list. We are going pretty long here, but let's take one more quick break and we'll be right back.
And we're back. I think that was our first break we've had to take.
Yeah.
In the middle of an episode, Andre needed his computer charge. I needed to go to the restroom. So, yeah, it's a long episode, but I'm loving it. I think we got a lot of good stuff on the show. And, yeah, we'll talk more about it about that at the end. Now we're going to continue our list of future unicorn companies with a company called C2FO. This is actually a Kansas City company that lives not super far from my house.
Nice.
That is operated out of not super far from my house. They're from Lenexa, Kansas. And interesting enough, this was the only company from the entire Midwest on this list.
Oh, man.
Including Chicago. Everything else was either in California, like Massachusetts. The only one I saw that wasn't like there was one in D.C. and then one in Georgia. So
yeah. Interestingly, D.C., like Virginia area, has been a really hotbed for new tech companies and tech investments in existing companies.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm happy to see we have some representation from the Midwest, even if it's just one company. And I'm even happier to see that it's a Kansas City startup that I'd actually already heard about. So what C2FO is they are a market for working capital. And you want to talk about companies that I struggled to kind of understand what they were doing. this was that. So the way I thought about it is when you're a company, like you send out these invoices and you have to wait a certain amount of time for those invoices to come back, and they kind of enable you to get that capital earlier. I'm not exactly sure how this works. It's through some sort of interest discounting system. I don't know. I tried to read up on it. It was pretty confusing. Didn't have enough time to really dig deep into it. But basically, they help supply cash flow, you know, enable companies to get working capital quicker. They are always on, like, the top startups in Kansas City list, top startups in Midwest list, and, you know, future unicorn. That's a pretty huge distinction. So it's an interesting company if maybe you're more on the business, you know, managing cash flow side of things. This is something that you should definitely look into, because they are making some noise. It's just not really something that, as a student, really tangential to my life at all. You know?
I mean, about a year ago, we took accounting, and that's the last I wanted to hear about cash accounts flow, receivables. Yeah.
So, I mean, any of the ventures I've done, you know, the only cash flow problems I've had is ever generating any at all. So,
yeah.
not really in the market for this, obviously, but interesting nonetheless to see a Kansas City company here. And then the next company is another unique on the list. It's the only company from the UK on the list, and it's called CityMapper. Have you used this before?
I've not. I'm looking at it right now, and all I can say is their first page is very busy.
Oh, yeah. No, they have a ton of information, and that kind of reflects what the app itself has. So it is essentially like your complete guide to transit in any city. They aggregate transit information from bus systems, docked bikes, dockless bikes, trains, car sharing services, ride sharing services like Uber and Lyft, and you can kind of get them all in one place. And along with seeing their availability, you can also select a destination. Let's say you want to go across downtown Chicago, it'll tell you take an Uber or a nearby bike to get to this point, walk down into the subway, take the subway to this stop, walk over to this bike point, you know, bike from there, catch an Uber here. It'll combine all of these different modes of transit in one kind of trip and guide you through it step by step.
Yeah. I've got two thoughts here. First, this seems like a prime acquisition for Uber. Obviously, they would love to have something like this with their whole vision of becoming the future of transport. And as we talked about last week, they're adding public transport to the app. This would help them even more. I'll leave that for another day. It almost makes too much sense that they're from the UK and that this is the only one from the UK, because in Europe, there are so many more modes of transportation that are not Uber or Lyft.
Yeah.
There are better train systems, better bus systems, all that kind of stuff. And so having this in the UK seems very important, and even all over Europe. And I also am looking at, they have this Twitter feed where they kind of show an aggregate of all of their like positive tweets and stuff. And it very much seems like they are using either straight up European languages or using more European terms and spellings. So you can tell their user base is very
European.
And I think it'd be great, or even better, rather, if the U.S. had better public transportation. But then it does show, like, Chicago, which has a pretty okay rail system. So, you know, whatever you need to use, I'm sure this works with it.
Yeah, so there's a couple apps I've seen in the app stores like this, and I just don't go to cities enough to ever really need to buy into a thing like this. You know, I usually, if I'm in a city, I'll just take an Uber or a Lyft to wherever I'm going, and it's just kind of a one-step thing for me. But if you're maybe more budget conscious, and you're traveling to a part of a city that you haven't been before, something like this could be an interesting thing to look at. I thought the comment about Uber, like, acquiring these is interesting because it makes me wonder if they ever would, because aside from the bus and train transit, all the other, you know, the bikes and the other apps, those are all direct competitors to Uber, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, Uber's trying to do their own bike stuff, and they want to get involved in every possible layer that they can. So I hope that, you know, Uber expands their offering to be able to do kind of like we said when we were talking about this multimodal transit, you know, it's not the most efficient thing to take a car everywhere you're going. So kind of including different stages of transportation in a longer trip could be cool. But I doubt we'll see them including, you know, Lyft rides or
I would hope at least
bike things.
Yeah, I would hope at least that they price aggressively enough that they could show you the price of an Uber and the price of a Lyft and be like, look, it's very clearly cheaper to take this Uber.
Yeah. So I just wonder how much of a competitor these guys are to Uber, like what they see them as. But yeah, I totally take your point about it being much more effective in the UK to take all these different types of transit.
Yeah, we might have to try this out in Seattle because traffic in Seattle is terrible. Taking an Uber isn't super viable because it'll be expensive no matter where you go, especially if we're trying to get out to the suburbs to see our friends at Microsoft.
And they have those Lime bikes in Seattle. So it's like, I wonder if this app is able to see where they are.
Mm-hmm. And the bus system in Seattle is pretty decent.
Yeah.
It'll be really exciting. Hopefully we can check this out and kind of report back to everybody on our experience with it.
In a few months.
Yep.
So, yeah, next on the list is a company called Mapbox. Andre, have you ever heard of Mapbox?
I have not.
Okay, I'd heard of Mapbox, and they're another platform that kind of, this is a pattern, you know, they're a company that is enabling other innovative types of companies, and they're kind of like an alternative to using Google Maps to back your app. So when companies like Snapchat or Tinder or CNN need to include a map in their app, your options are like Mapbox, there's like an open source version, like more community based that's less reliable, or Google Maps.
Yes, I have heard of Mapbox. Okay. Yes, for sure. That's what powers the Snap Map, correct?
Yes.
Yes, I remembered at some point seeing like powered by Mapbox somewhere on the Snapchat thing.
Exactly.
Yes, it's coming back to me.
So yeah, it's an alternative to using Google Maps. They have like traffic aware ETA times, so you can see, like, just like you can in every other navigation thing, you know, like which streets are probably busy. But then the interesting part of the company to me, and the other reason that I'd heard of them, was that they are providing data for AR based applications. So when you think Pokemon Go, if you ever used it, there were these places you could go in real life that were gyms, you know, stuff like that. And when you go to like a certain spot on the map, maybe there's a Pokemon there, you can go catch it. And these guys go even a step further where if you think about like you're walking down the street, you could place a sign in AR and like set it up in space. You know, maybe you attach it to like a your apartment and say like, this is my apartment, and it's like in your little window on the floor. This company enables what's called global object persistence. So using their technology, an app could save that, and then another user could come by looking around and see that sign exactly where you placed it on your house.
Yes, I remember several years ago, we would have probably been like freshmen in high school at that point. There was this like proto Pokemon Go type game. I don't remember what it was called.
Ingress or something like
that? Yes, that was it. It was powered by Google. maps.
Yep.
But you just kind of walked around and like hit points. And there was a point at one of the places by a park by my house. And so I would walk over there, just kind of like see how it worked.
Yeah.
And it had some global object persistence with like, you could set things down. I don't remember exactly how it worked, but that's where I had first kind of heard about that stuff.
Yeah. So this is another platform that enables that sort of thing. I know that Pokemon Go did use like Google stuff, right?
Yeah. Cause they're Niantic owned by Google. Is a break off of Google from after the Alphabet.
Yep. So, and then another side note about that, do you see they're doing Harry Potter next?
I did see that, yeah.
Yeah, so there's been some rumblings about that upcoming thing. I'm very excited to see, like, how big it gets.
Yeah.
I wonder if people will go crazy for it again. And then on top of that, back to Pokemon Go. We each have a friend who is still very much into Pokemon Go.
Yes.
And it surprises me to this day how much some people stuck around with that game. But I think being in Rakes probably skews that.
Yeah.
Skews that a little bit. But yeah. Okay. So here we are at the last company. The company is called Alto Pharmacy. And this is something that I think if you've really thought about where the future of pharmacies are going, you probably thought of this. It's an online pharmacy.
Yeah. Online pharmacies, telemedicine, all of this kind of stuff is just really emerging quickly.
Yeah, so it's a company, I think it's the first one I'd heard of where it'll deliver the drugs to your doorstep, kind of eliminating the need to go into CVS.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. I mean, there's CVSs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big, massive chain, you know, and a company like this could really disrupt that sort of space by saving you that trip.
Just wait until Amazon buys them, and then we have drones delivering our medicine.
Yep. So, yeah. So, it's more than just the delivery. They have online platforms for healthcare providers and existing pharmacies. And kind of the second facet outside of the convenience is that they're trying to use all this technology to find you the best price for the most effective drug. The ideal is that they're saving you money. They say that they've saved patients $11 million so far by using this technology to find that best price for the best value. I don't really know how this works, like what it looks like when they say like they have a platform for pharmacists and healthcare providers, if they're really like, you know, providing full like online systems for these companies to operate, or if it's just something where like your doctor can say, I prescribe this drug, and then they can look at the different options and say like, okay, yes, I'm going to choose that option for my patient. But yeah, it's definitely something to keep an eye on. It is extremely limited by location right now. Yeah. It's only in the San Francisco area, LA, and Orange County. So only very hotbeds in
basically California. Two places in California.
So that's kind of lame, but definitely be on the lookout for the future of pharmacy where, you know, you go on your app to like see how your prescription's doing, you know, get it ordered, get stuff delivered directly to your door.
Yeah, it'll be kind of fun to see how far this goes, and I really do think it could go very far.
Obviously, it's a huge industry, so yeah, it could go very far. And like you said, Amazon's already made moves in the healthcare space with their big project that they're working on with Berkshire Hathaway and another company. So I don't think it would really surprise anybody if Amazon started delivering your drugs as well.
No, I don't think so either.
So yeah, here we are at the end of our longest episode yet.
Let's see, an hour and 18 minutes in right now.
I had a lot of fun making this episode. It was a lot more of an involved process. You know, I think I read more news this week than I ever have. But I think that putting in this extra effort really allowed us to discover like more great content.
Yeah, it really lets us have news articles that we want to talk about even more.
For sure.
And at the heart, Hacker Slacker is a tech news podcast. So we may have spent 50 minutes on the news today, but that's because we really care about getting out all the good news. And obviously, we want your feedback on this kind of stuff. Maybe it was too long for you. Maybe it was too short. Maybe you really like the long news sections. We just really like to hear from you.
Yeah, so feel free to reach out to us at our email.
Hackerslackerpod@gmail.com or on Twitter @hackerspod.
Yep. So, and then stay tuned to the Twitter to see the stories that we'll be including in next week's episode. Just since you made it to the end here, you know, you must really love the show if you stuck with us all this way. And me and Andre would really appreciate it if you, one of our great fans, would share this podcast with a friend, you know, get more listeners for us. We have a ton of exciting stuff coming on top of this new, like, more energy that we're putting into the show to create more stories. We have some really great interviews lined up.
Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about these interviews we're about to have.
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff scheduled, so definitely be on the lookout for that next week's episode. A little sneak peek about it. It's someone from the X workflow team at Apple, and if you know who that, or if you know what that means, then you'll know it's going to be pretty exciting. So definitely be on the lookout for that. And like I said, please share the podcast. We would love to grow, mainly for the purpose of just getting more feedback, so that we can really see what you guys are thinking and how it's going. So yeah, I think that's all I got.
Yeah, you can send us an email, like we've said several times. Shoot us an email at hackerslackerpod@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter, please. We are a good follow. We're trying to make it better at hackerspod on Twitter. We really enjoyed today. Give us some feedback, and we will see you next week.
Bye.